When police officers are accused of wrongdoing, many experts say they can generally count on the so-called blue wall of silence to protect them. It's a term used to describe an unofficial agreement between officers not to report a colleague's transgressions. But many are breaking with that unofficial code to condemn the actions of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who's on trial for the death of George Floyd, who died after Chauvin held his knee on Floyd's neck. On the witness stand last week, Minneapolis Police Chief Madaria Arredondo said that Chauvin's restraint of Floyd should have ended when Floyd stopped resisting arrest and when he tried to verbalize that he was in distress.
To continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the trial of Derek Chauvin? What has stuck out to you about the way his colleagues, leading law enforcement officers, are speaking about him? Do you think this marks any kind of turning point in how law enforcement grapples with issues of wrongdoing, or do you think it's an isolated incident? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Philip Stinson is an assistant professor in the Criminal Justice Program in the Department of Human Services at Bowling Green State University. He's a former police officer and attorney. He created one of the country's most comprehensive data sets on police misconduct. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Good to be with you.
Before we get into the particulars of the trial of Derek Chauvin, Phil, I want to ask about this concept of the blue wall of silence. I think at least in popular perception, it exists. Is it a reality in police forces, do you think?
Well, it's certainly something that's been written about in the policing scholarship really for the last 100 years or so. Going back to the early 1930s, we can find scholarship that talks about this. Certainly, more recently, the prevalent view is that the blue wall of the more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the country. What I've seen over the last decade or so, though, in my research. So I study police crime. We look at non-federal sworn law enforcement officers who were arrested for anything. It could be drunk driving, murder, and everything in between, on-duty or off-duty crimes. And I've studied this for almost 17 years now, back since 2005 or so. And in my research, what I've seen is that there are some things that fellow officers are simply not willing to cover for. There are some things that are simply so egregious, so over the top, lacking in any rational explanation at all in terms of police behaviors that that an officer's peers simply will not cover for them. And that's often the case with fatal shootings by police officers and other in-custody deaths, if you will, where we see that other officers come forward. Oftentimes it's in the case of on-duty shootings where the legal standard is that an officer is legally justified in using deadly force if the officer has a reasonable apprehension of an imminent threat of serious bodily injury or death being imposed against the officer or someone else. And the Supreme Court has said that that's a standard of objective reasonableness. In other words, what a reasonable police officer on the scene without the benefit of hindsight would have perceived. So the first place that investigators and prosecutors go is to talk to other officers on the scene. And what we've seen is that in these types of cases where they're just egregious incidents, we find that other officers on the scene tell it like it is. And if they don't think that they perceive the threat, they're going to say so. And that seems to be the exception or the times where other officers will come forward. And then we've seen that in this case as well, where you have the police chief and everybody on down who's testifying in this case for the behalf of the prosecution.
Looking at this case in particular now, we see, as you say, the police chief, others, police experts from other agencies around the country being very willing to speak critically of this officer on trial. He and other officers on the scene were fired, I think, the day after George Floyd's death. Does this, do you think, fit into that category of egregious misconduct that you were just talking about a moment ago, where that that's going to overcome that maybe initial blue wall of silence?
I think it's egregious, absolutely. But I also think that this case, the Derek Chauvin prosecution, is an outlier. It's a show trial. Everybody's paying attention. It's not just a local or regional news event. It's a national, international news event on a daily basis for weeks on end as we see this trial, which will probably extend out over a month long. So it's an outlier. It's an unusual case. It's a show trial. I don't think that it really suggests that there's a title change, that we're seeing a breaking down of that blue wall of silence, that the code of silence is disappearing. What we really need to focus on in terms of police reforms are changing police behaviors, changing the police subculture, because all the policies can be changed. Reforms can be legislated from state capitals and from Washington, D.C. But unless we change the behaviors and the socialization process, the cultural processes at work within law enforcement agencies, I don't think we can make meaningful change systemically going forward.
Talking to Philip Stinson, professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University, also a former police officer, looking at the idea of a blue wall of silence when police officers are or aren't, in some cases, willing to testify against one another. The Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis, an example where clearly many in the police department in Minneapolis and beyond willing to testify against the former officer. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Robert is with us in Stevens Point. Robert, hello.
Hi. First thing of all, I think that police officers are indoctrinated with a thought process that they are better than others. And that proves a very big problem, because when you think you're better than your human man, your co-person living in the world, it's not conducive to you being having any empathy or support for each other or having any thought concept about what that person's life is, because that person is a live being. You are a live being as a police officer. They should know better. And I think the way they could correct it is they could have send them back to school, send them back to training, and, you know, bit by bit, and teach them that these are not acceptable ways to treat people, and that by retraining them and reprogramming them, you might have a chance.
Robert, can I ask, have you had experience on either side of law enforcement?
Yes, I have. And I will tell you that when you get police officers and you get district attorneys involved, and they're all out there hanging out, they don't care about you at all. They don't care. They care about themselves and what they're doing. And to sit there and say, oh, well, it's just one bad apple. No, I'm sorry to tell you, that tree is rotten. They need to really do something about the police.
Robert, thanks for the call. And Phil, Robert, I think speaking some to that culture change you were just talking about, what do you hear from what Robert said there?
Right. Well, thank you, Robert, for your comments. I do think that police officers are socialized early in their career as recruits into an us versus them world where it's police officers and everybody else. And oftentimes with this warrior mentality, it soon becomes everybody else is an enemy. So I think Robert makes some good points there. I do worry, though, as to whether we can train our way out of it. You know, an hour or two or half a day's implicit bias training every year, I don't know that that can really change, as Robert called, thought processes, behaviors of police officers. I tend to agree with Robert that it's not just a few bad apples. Now, I want to be careful with that because there are many good police officers, and I don't want to suggest otherwise. However, I think we've seen enough of these cases, even though this case, the Chauvin case, is an outlier, as I said earlier. I think we're dealing more than a few bad apples. The problem with the bad apples theory is that a police chief or a mayor can say, well, we had a bad apple here. We got rid of the bad apple and everything's okay. The police department can move forward now. And I think that's been disproven certainly as far back as the Knapp Commission in the early 1970s and the Mullen Commission in the 1990s in New York City. It's more systemic than that at many agencies across the country. And we really need to rethink not only what it is we want police officers to be doing as their jobs and their core functions, but what type of people do we want to be police officers?
But thanks a lot for that call, Robert. Given the nature of the job, Phil, it is stressful. It is clearly sometimes dangerous. Police officers want to know that their fellow officers have their back. It kind of invites us seeing that kind of loyalty as a virtue, and maybe it can almost lead naturally to that us versus them mentality. If it takes more than just a little bit of training here and there, what is it going to take to not have that, what you call it, us versus them mentality?
Well, one of the problems that I see, you know, a lot of people talk about institutional racism, and I want to break it down even further. I think that many people, many police officers, I think that many police officers, not all, but many police officers have a fear of Black people, and more often than not, Black males. And we see that time and again. And somehow we've got to rethink all of this. We've got to make sure that our police officers are from and of and about the communities in which they serve, in which they work on a daily basis, that they aren't living in completely different ways where they're coming in a quasi-military organization to go to war every day to fight crime. We've got to rethink all of this. And until we do that, I don't think we can get away from these problems.
We're talking about the Derek Chauvin trial and the so-called blue wall of silence with Philip Stinson. He's a professor in the criminal justice program in the Department of Human Services at Bowling Green State University. He's a former police officer himself and attorney. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Derek Chauvin trial will change law enforcement in any way? If so, how? What do you make of the fact that many police officers, many of the former officers' superiors testifying that they do think he went outside of his training, misused force in the case of George Floyd? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Phil Stinson, professor in the Criminal Justice Program in the Department of Human Services at Bowling Green State University, former police officer. We're talking to him about how uncommon it is for police officers to speak out against their colleagues and how we are seeing that happen, some during the Derek Chauvin trial. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a current or former police officer? What have you been thinking about during the trial of Derek Chauvin and the death of George Floyd? Do you think there's something missing from the conversation when we talk about law enforcement and accountability? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Phil, have you seen departments around the country, or maybe even other countries if you look that far, that you think are taking good steps towards some of the changes you're looking for when it comes to police culture?
Well, yeah, I think in some respects we're starting to see some agencies rethink some of their core functions. I don't know that it's a good idea to remove the role of traffic enforcement, traffic stops away from sworn officers. I worry a lot about that. I worry that there'll be a horrific incident where a city employee not carrying any weapons is making a traffic stop. You know, that's been proposed in some places across the country. And the first time, you know, one of those personnel gets seriously injured or killed, I think will be the end of that experiment. I don't have the answer, but it's very difficult. I mean, there are variations within agencies as to how they socialize their officers and the culture within the agencies. But we do see some core elements that are seemingly systemic, that seemingly from agency to agency are very similar and have the same values.
Let's go back to our callers now. Dale is with us in Merrill. Dale, hello.
Yep. You got me still?
Yep. What did you want to bring up, Dale?
So I've been a law enforcement officer for 35 years, and I can tell you as a law enforcement officer, I evolved over those last 35 years. I'm in supervision now. And I always kind of tell people when I first started, I wasn't a very nice person because I saw the world very much black and white, right and wrong. And it took time to understand what law enforcement is, and is that we are human beings. We're not supermen. We have some skill sets, but our primary mission is to try to make the community safe for everybody. And And on the side of my wall, when people walk out of my office, I'm a supervisor, I have the oath of office up there to remind them every day that you are sworn to faithfully and impartially do the job to the best of your ability. And I always speak to my officers, the person we're dealing with today that is antisocial, that has done something wrong, is a redeemable person that tomorrow could be our victim or could be our ally, our witness in another crime. And it's about, you got to deal with people's misconduct, you got to deal with accountability, but you always want to try to have that building of rapport when it's done and treat them like a decent human being, because you're going to see them again. And if they remember you as a person that treated them like a human being, it may not go as bad next time.
Dale, I'm really glad you called. I want to take you back 35 years ago or so, Dale. Is there something that you wish you had been either formally trained or just in the culture of the agency you worked at first, something you wish you'd heard then to make that journey, I don't know, faster for you?
Kind of what I've just said. I mean, back then I started under revolver days, and back then it was a very much us versus them. There was this law enforcement is better than the person on the street, which is not the case. We're human beings. Every one of us is a flawed and imperfect person. And there always was this, and you still see it, and I deal with younger officers who are in the profession trying to get them to see people as people. Now, they're engaged in some pretty violent, sometimes very hostile actions towards you, but that's the 1% of their life. The 99% of their life, they generally aren't that way. And we only deal with people generally at their worst, not their best. I wish somebody would have, like I'm trying to do with young officers now, kind of turn on that light, because we can avoid bad things happening. It's a lot easier for everybody. It's a better.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, Dale. Phil, what do you think?
Well, I thank Dale for his comments. I agree with what he said. I think the question is, how do we get those young officers to the point of enlightenment, if you will, so that they perhaps calm down a bit, so that they see people that they interact with as individual persons, not really in an us versus them mentality. And I think that's a big question going forward. How do we get, how do we socialize the officers? How do we train them? What kind of people do we want to become police officers? Because one of the things, you know, I track almost 300 variables for every case in my research where we have officers who've been arrested. We have over 18,000 cases of officers being arrested for any type of crime imaginable since 2005. And one of those 300 or so variables is years of service at time of arrest. And we do see some patterns and some very distinct changes in terms of the types of behaviors that we see based on years of service. So I think Dale raises some interesting points. On the flip side to that, by the way, Dale, be careful. We also see late in career that sometimes officers become very, very cynical, and that can lead to different types of poor behavioral choices by police officers. So we're constantly looking at that as well, so that we can help officers later in their career stay on track and transition to retirement easier, because some officers late in their career have difficulties with sort of planning for that transition.
Thanks again for that call. We'll go next to Ross in Middleton. Ross, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Bill. 60-year-old guy. I spent some time in the military, so I kind of get the warrior concept, but I ended up in healthcare. And the question that I have, when I talk about these kind of issues with my colleagues and friends or whatever, there's sort of this expectation of some people to say, if a policeman shows up, you automatically sort of do what they say. You sort of, you follow what they're saying. You follow their orders and be a good citizen. But it seems to me like what human nature is, and the police will show up when an individual is already revved up, and it seems to me, instead of trying to, like in a mental health situation, talk this person down, they immediately sort of play hardball and expect this individual to just somehow, through a miracle, to just automatically calm down. And it seems like in Jacob Blake and Kenosha and George Floyd, and I'm sure others, it just seems like there's this expectation of the ultimate victim to have calmed down when it's against human nature.
Ross, thanks for the call. So that expectation of compliance, Phil, when somebody's in the midst of maybe a mental health crisis.
Yeah. So the whole idea of recognizing what the individual's status is, but then also de-escalation. And some officers are better than others at de-escalation, but that's one area we have seen a lot of movement on in the last 5 years or so, with the renewed emphasis on de-escalation training, is in-service training for officers, where officers really need to develop better strategies at how to calm the situation down, de-escalate situations, as opposed to escalating situations. Because sometimes what we see in these cases is that officers arrive on the scene, and as Ross was alluding to, they immediately escalate the situation. So somebody who's already, as Ross said, ramped up is not going to respond well to that. And we need to really look at a lot of this as how to treat people who are in mental health crises. And a lot of places, police officers do a good job of that, but in many other places, they do a poor job of it.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Phil, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, as always.
We've been talking to Philip Stinson, professor in the criminal justice program at the Department of Human Services at Bowling Green State University. He's a former police officer and attorney. He created one of the country's most comprehensive data sets on police misconduct. He joined us today to talk about the code of silence that police allegedly provide colleagues accused of wrongdoing, and why it's not necessarily happening that way during the Derek Chauvin trial going on now in Minneapolis.